The more things change, the more they stay the same. If you do not believe this cute little aphorism, you should dig into the ancient commentary of the classics, where you will find thinkers that lead you to ask, how does one become a farmer?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1290th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Monaco who are tuned into the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, they are called classics because they do not wear out with time, even with thousands of years of time. The writers of the classics captured life as they saw it with the words of their day. If one is able to translate those ancient words into today's words, or get someone else to do the translating, one can see that the more things change, the more they stay the same. For one example, look back, way back, to what the shepherd Hesiod had to say nearly 3,000 years ago about character. The best man of all thinks out everything for himself, mulling over what is better later on, and in the end. And yet good too is he who heeds words well spoken by another. But whoever neither thinks for himself nor listens to another, when he takes something to heart, is a useless person. Now I ask, has the wisdom of that observation dimmed over the nearly 3 millennia since it was written? Though there are some who think there is now no such thing as a useless person, they most likely have never been a farmer. And speaking of farming, the ancients did a lot of writing on the subject, and as I thumbed through the themes presented in How to Be a Farmer, an ancient guide to the life on the land, I see many, if not most all, of the themes I have written and talked about in my travels up and down today's food chain. To see how, the more things change, the more they stay the same, let's open How to Be a Farmer and see how what was said about farming in ancient times is pretty much the way farming is today. Here to help us select from all the themes, translate them from the Greek and Latin into today's American English, and introduce him to us, we have, from Francis Cote d'Azur, the author of How to Be a Farmer, an Ancient Guide to Life on the Land, M.D. Usher, farmer and professor of classical languages and literature at the University of Vermont. Well, Professor, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you very much, and plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, as they say around here.
Well, good.
The more things change, the more they change, they stay the same.
There you go. So it's a pretty much of a universal thought, isn't it?
It was originally said of fashion, but I think it applies to ideas as well.
Let us know, which came first, the professor of classics or the farmer?
Yes, the chicken and the egg question. That's a tough one to answer. All my life, I've been doing things with my hands, and before I even went to college in the first place, I aspired to be a carpenter and actually trained as one in Germany. And then only after that, and after I met my now wife, did I pursue sort of the academic realm. And so I guess to answer honestly, I think the idea of labor and work close to the land and working with your hands came first, but there was a big interstitial space in between called graduate school and, you know, the responsibilities of being a professor that have taught me how to balance the two. But in terms of the chicken and egg question, the farming or the aspiration to farm came first.
There you go. But it was a woman that made you do it, right?
You mean, what would that be, my wife?
Yes.
Yes, a woman is always the source of a face that launches a thousand ships in all of our lives.
There you go.
So, yeah, I just actually got off a WhatsApp call with my wife less than 10 minutes ago. She's, of course, holding down the farm right now while I'm here in Marseille and talking to you. where the sun shines, it seems, every day. And she's coping with a lame bullock right now. So we were trying to negotiate over WhatsApp while she was out in the field, how to get a ram who was in with the cows at this point out, so she could try to move the bullock out. So she deserves a lot of credit in a lot of ways for what we do.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is a farmer like you doing in the Côte d'Azur of France during harvest season in Vermont?
Well, so one of the benefits of being an academic is that sometimes you get nice scholarships or fellowships or support for your research. You don't always do that. And I was lucky enough to get a fellowship to the French Institute for Advanced Study, located here in Marseille. There's several around France at the universities in France. This one here, I'm resident at for the year. I won't be here nonstop throughout the course of the year. I'll need to go back several times to manage things on the home front and help out with especially the winter chores in Vermont on the farm can be intimidating and substantial. But that's what brought me here, and I'm working on projects related to, or sort of spin-off projects related to, the book you described, How to Be a Farmer.
Well, how did you come to write How to Be a Farmer? Because you are a farmer, you are a professor of the classics. So was it what you were reading in the classics that got you to thinking it's just like it was back then?
Another great question. And, you know, there are people in my field, in classics and ancient history, who specialize in ancient agriculture, and that's their shtick. I'm not actually one of those people. I'm a literature person, primarily. I prefer poetry to prose. I prefer philosophy to history, even, as my just temperament and my aptitudes go. But my wife Caroline had the idea about 5-6 years ago that instead of living this double life as a farmer on the one hand and a academic on the other, I should try to marry those two interests. And of course, when she said that, it reminded me of a poem, and that poem is by Robert Frost. And Robert Frost said that was his goal in life, to unite his avocation and his vocation. And I think if you're lucky enough to be able to do that, you've got a golden life. And that's how I got interested in kind of the ancient ideology of farming and what, you know, living close to nature in all respects, not just farming, but other ways that the ancients can teach us about how we can live kind of in accordance with nature in a very critical time in the world's history, the planet's history, i.e. today.
Today. Well, so, let's start this discussion off with how would you describe what makes a classic a classic?
The term classic refers to sort of a category of writings. The Latin word means fleet, and like a naval fleet. So we have this this fleet of works from antiquity that kind of go together because they were thought at some point over the course of history and continue to be thought somehow representative and of that world's way of thinking, and perhaps maybe even some of the best of that world's thinking, the ancient world's thinking about all matters, scientific, humanistic, artistic. And so they came to be sort of like a canonical set, as it were. And of course, we just have the tip of the iceberg. There's much from classical literature that doesn't survive, and many voices that aren't heard. What we have is primarily the works of elites, but it is quite a broad swathe of worldview that we get from the classics, spanning thousands of years. So that's where classics come from.
Well, those of us who are not students of the classics look back and we hear the names mentioned, and they seem so distant and so strange. And I see where you wrote a kind of a personality profile of Socrates that really kind of brought the person to life for me. Would you give our audience a thumbnail of who you think Socrates was? What was he like? What was it like to have a friend named Socrates?
Nice question. Annoying. So he was the kind of friend that would challenge you and make you uncomfortable and irk you. But he would have been reliable as well, and somebody you could trust and perhaps confide in. But, you know, he was sort of a street urchin in Athens. And I think, you know, young people in ancient Athens particularly took to him and his methods because he was fond of showing up, you know, the habits and the ideas of pretentious people and reducing them to, you know, really nothing in his discourse and his exchanges with them. So, yeah, Socrates, I mean, his fellow Athenians killed him after all.
He did.
So, he did annoy people, but he was relentless in his quest for truth. And as he's portrayed, especially by Plato, you know, he is the patron saint of philosophers, somebody who just never gives up and is going to pursue the truth. And no matter what the consequence to himself or you know, to others.
And the consequence, of course, was that he paid with the ultimate price, right?
Indeed.
He did indeed. Now, and one more quick question before we move on to some of the really interesting people that you bring to life in How to Be a Farmer. How do you entice students of today who are raised with video games on their cell phones? How do you entice them with the classics?
Mm. Well, you know, I'm always surprised, I'll tell you the truth, Michael, that students of this generation seem to have a certain ennui has set in with students and technology. At least the students that I've seen in the last 5 years in my courses. And I teach courses on sort of the backstory of sustainability in the classical world, backstory of sort of ecological thinking in the ancient world. So maybe that some of those students are self-selecting and are drawn to that topic, but they see actually the truth of the statement you opened the show with, that the more things change, the more they stay the same. They see a persistence of validity in ancient views that are relevant to them. And sometimes by looking back and away from something contemporary and present, even if it's similar, it seems fresh and new or even exotic. And it can mobilize you and certainly give you enthusiasm to learn more. And that sort of process of discovery, I find the classics are really, really good to teach with for that reason.
Well, that's great. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to pick up some of the classics and some of the classic writers and learn a lot about how the more things change, the more they stay the same. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're spanning the globe, actually. We're on the west coast of the United States and on the Côte d'Azur of France. When they say Côte d'Azur, what do they mean by that, Professor?
Well, the Azure coast on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. It's a where I am is definitely a Mediterranean culture and quite a multinational and multi-ethnic culture. So
it's
and Marseille, of course, is a very ancient city going back to a Greek foundation in the 5th century BCE. So
a long time, and of course, that indeed. Mediterranean world is, you know, the seat of that ancient culture of Rome and Greece and whatnot. So, and you, I note, put a lot of the original language, in the book, How to Be a Farmer. Why did you put the original Greek and Latin in the book?
These books are the brainchild of the editor of the series, Rob Tempio. And there's a couple of things going on with them. One is that they are trying to popularize the classics and make them accessible to modern readers and kind of repackage them to be attractive in that way, both by subject matter and presentation. But there's also a cheeky sort of inside joke that perhaps nobody else but a classicist would realize going on. And that is, these books are a visual parody of a well-known series used by scholars of the classics called the Loeb Classical Library. And the format of the books, these books in this library, and this was founded by James Loeb, worth money by James Loeb, a Harvard benefactor at the turn of the century, last century, the aspiration was to include all Greek and Roman authors in translation with the original text on the facing page. And the Greek ones were green and the Latin ones were red, and they still are. And there are new Loeb's being published as I speak, and it's all online now, so you can actually find it perhaps through your local university library if they have a subscription. So Princeton's books in this series, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Readers, they're a visual parody of that, both in the small size of the book and the facing pages of, you know, ancient language on one side on the left and then English on the right. The only difference is that I've described these as the Benetton of Loeb's, because the cover is always a different color. They can be yellow, they can be brown, like my book, black. So there's some booksellers things going on behind the scenes in this series.
There you go. Always is. Somebody has to sell books. And they were selling books way back then, way back before BC. And let's in that regard, let's pick up some of your characters and run with them. Let's start with Hesiod, 750 yep. to 650 BC.
Yeah, he is arguably our first known author from antiquity, from, you know, Greek and Roman antiquity, certainly. So, you know, your listeners have probably heard of Homer. You know, Homer is a name that we give to the poet of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but we have, you know, no reliable information about who composed both of those poems or if it was the same person and what his name was even. But with Hesiod, it's different. You know, Hesiod speaks in his first person, in the first person. You know, he may be adopting a poetic persona as he conveys his information and tells the ancient Greek myths in his poetry and gives this sage advice, like is in the book, How to Be a Farmer, about how to live and how to live in an agricultural society. But, you know, he speaks in the first person, that he is, he's a real author. And probably composed these poems orally, but may have written them down himself. And so he's the beginning of it all. So he's unique in a couple of different ways, both in terms of the content of his thinking, but also just by virtue of the fact that he begins the whole tradition of the tradition of the classics.
Well, one of the things that he picks up on is he's chewing out his brother for being a ne'er-do-well, and instead of working on the farm and doing things that make sense, running off into town and getting into political trouble of this sort and that sort. And, yes. You know, that lends me to think of Thomas Jefferson and his notion that the morals, you cannot corrupt the morals of farmers because then they would fail at farming and they wouldn't be a farmer anymore. And do you see anybody in your neighborhood who is a successful farmer who runs off to town and gets into these silly scrapes and survives and prospers?
I didn't catch that last part of the question, but your invocation of Thomas Jefferson is pitch perfect because, you know, Jefferson, he was steeped in the classics, and his whole notion of, you know, what it means to be a gentleman farmer or a citizen farmer and, you know, an educated person, pretty much every author that we have in this volume, How to Be a Farmer, was a Thomas Jefferson of some sort of his time. That is, you know, an educated elite who saw value in living close to the land and saw problems with the problems that come with civilization and with, you know, political, social interaction and preferring the one to the other. What you just described and attributed to Jefferson's view is expressed perfectly in the passage of from Virgil in this book. So Virgil, you know, says the farmer doesn't care about politics, and the farmer is, as you say, virtually incorruptible in that way because he doesn't care about that. He cares. He has too much else on his plate and in his mind. And Virgil presents him even as a sort of a philosopher of sorts, who understands the value not only of labor, but also knows how the world works, knows how to plant and to sow and to reap and how nature responds to human interaction with it.
And with that, let's pick up Rufus, who suggests that farming is the best job for a philosopher.
So, right. Okay.
Tell us about Rufus. Who was Rufus?
Okay. Musonius Rufus was a Stoic philosopher who lived in Rome in the second century AD. And he's often called the Roman Socrates. And he's called that because he wrote in Greek, but you know he was active in the Roman Empire. He's called that because his concern, the concern expressed in all of his writings, are mostly for ethics and how to live in the world. He's not so concerned about the technicalities of philosophy that involve logic, or he's not so much interested in the particularities of physics or, you know, a scientific knowledge of the world. He's ultimately interested in how to behave. So that focus on ethics is exactly what earned him the nickname the Roman Socrates, because that was Socrates' concern. Whereas the other Stoics, or many other Stoics, were Stoicism by that time was quite an advanced philosophy with different branches and schools in it. They were much more concerned with, not much more concerned, but they were equally concerned with much more technical matter. And so in a way, Musonius represents sort of a simpler return to maybe the foundations of ethical philosophy. And you're right, he does give us the advice that farming is the best job for a philosopher, and he gives good reasons.
And there was another writer in the book that talked in How to Be a Farmer that talked about, there was a Stoic, and talked about how Stoicism represented this, really a look at modern science. And how the earth it starts with the atom and the interaction with other atoms and molecules. And it's kind of like a closed loop, this world we live in which right. Everything reacts with everything else. And it really does set the stage for an environmental consciousness, does it not?
I think that's a great point. And yes, I agree. The passage from Lucretius in the book. Lucretius was an Epicurean philosopher and an early atomist, so and a materialist. He thought that the world was comprised completely of little tiny itty bitty things that were called atoms. That's a Greek word that means something that's a tiny little thing that's indivisible. It's uncuttable. So and Epicureanism actually offered this scientific understanding of the world, this materialist understanding of the world and of life and of nature as a source of solace to human beings. Because if you understand the laws of nature and how nature works, so they argued, you wouldn't worry about things like death, because you would understand that death is just part of a cycle of life. And it's part of, as you say, sort of a ecological closed loop. And they actually had a kind of a, what do you want to say, a talking point in this regard. And it was this statement that nothing comes from nothing and nothing returns to nothing. So, I mean, I don't think you could find perhaps a better description or encapsulation of a closed loop system than that. And that was the Epicurean philosophy. And they saw it as a source of, again, solace in a world that perhaps didn't make sense, or when things happen that seem of divine origin or supernatural origin that were disruptive or overwhelming to human beings, they said, no, just take a step back and look at it empirically. And this is the way the world works. And if we understand it, we can also accept it and live happy lives.
And a couple of points on that. One is that it seems to be a direct correlation with one of the laws of thermodynamics, which says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. The same thing, isn't it?
It is. It's what Lucretius describes in the passage in the book is an anticipation of that. It's an adumbration of that, you know, and they didn't get everything right, but it amazes me. It never ceases to amaze me how, you know, ancient thinkers, ancient scientists really made so many advances, conceptual advances, without the aid of empirical instruments to measure and to record. I just find that remarkable and outstanding.
And the other point I wanted to make is that life on the farm is a perfect example of that closed loop in which everything, you know, farmer and farmer family, everything is living and dying on the farm. And so there Indeed. Really isn't any beginning and ending there. It's that continuum
right.
that represents, if you were raised in that, living and dying really aren't that much of a big deal. And I guess that's right. what the Stoics were trying to get at.
Well, the Epicureans, and Stoics did also, but in a different way. But the Epicureans, what you've just described, that would be very close to the way they thought about it. We are a point on a continuum. And when we give up the ghost, you know, our atoms are just being reabsorbed back into the universe to create more life. So, you know, the idea of pushing up daisies, you know, literally mm-hmm. a good farming metaphor or horticultural metaphor for death, that was their philosophy. Or at the core of their philosophy.
Well,
and in fact, I should also say, just because it tickles me every time I think about it, that I call that section in the book, that translation from Lucretius, the philosophy of compost. And Walt Whitman has a wonderful poem in Leaves of Grass called This Compost. And he expresses just the same sort of amazement we've been talking about of how, you know, wonderful things can come from decay, you know. He says, like, the blackberries are so flavorous and juicy that come out of, you know, dead people, right, in the ground or dead things in the ground. And some of the dead could be criminal. They could have committed terrible crimes. You know, they could have been abominations upon the earth, but yet they disintegrate and they become something that can become something beautiful and useful and enjoyable.
If conditions permit, I would guess. Another person you bring up is Marcus Varro, who brings up mm-hmm. the whole business of raising animals. And today, You know, we face a lot of anti-animal sentiment, mm-hmm. anti-animal agriculture sentiment. And yet Vero talks about that relationship that we share with animals. And of course, you happen to bring up Temple Grandin, because if anybody understands that relationship better than her, I don't know who that would be.
I agree.
So Vero, who's Vero? Yeah.
So yeah, Vero was one of these Thomas Jefferson kind of characters who, you know, was a public servant. He was one of the makers and shakers of late Republican Rome. Served in the army, held the high offices, but his real avocation was antiquities. You know, for him, antiquities meant going back to the beginning, but to study the past, to study language, to study myth and history. And farming. So he wrote a farming manual. It doesn't survive in toto, but it we have a good enough chunk to get a sense of what it was like, called Res Rusticae, Country Matters. And he dedicates this volume to his wife, Fundania, whose name actually means Mrs. Farmer, translated from Latin. She must be younger than he is. Vero's approaching 80 when he writes this work, Res Rusticae. And in the dedication, she has bought her own farm, her own, you know, estate, a villa. And she's looking for some advice, or at least maybe this is just the specious occasion to open the book, but she's looking for some advice from Vero on how to run it. And so that's the occasion for which Vero then delves into it's not a treatise so much, it's a dialogue between speakers who were well-known at the time, sort of imitative of Platonic dialogue, to talk about farming. And he preserves
everything. Can you hold on to that? We're going to take a quick break, but it's getting very rich here. We're going to be talking about animals and what Vero thought about them when we get right back. You stay tuned. Great.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. Business Money to Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money to Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. businessmoneytogo.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So much to talk about. An antiquity filled with very, very interesting things to talk about. Because it's essentially the same things we talk about today. Folks have been running up and down the food chain for, you know, best part of three decades. And exploring this and exploring that. And yet, you know, when I open up How to Be a Farmer, and scan through the subjects MD Usher puts on the table for us to consider, it seems like just about everything that is in that book are the things that I talk about and come to grips with in my perusal of today's food chain. And so, you know, it seems to me like the more things change, the more they stay the same, because what they wrote about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago is pretty much the same. Does that just amaze you? Do you find a continuing source of amazement in that, Professor?
Well, it encourages me because it means we have a resource beyond the present and beyond the future, which we don't know yet, to have recourse to. You know, and I think it's important for understanding the present to, I said this before, to look away, especially to the past. We find ourselves, I think, incorrigible presentists. We find ourselves always thinking that what's happening now is the most important, or what's happening now is actually new, when in fact it's not. It's a version of something that as humans have either thought up before or tried before. And that's one of the advantages of studying the past, is that it further elucidates the present, so we know how we got here. And it doesn't mean that we take things from the past wholesale. For instance, Roman farms were run primarily by slaves, doing the hard graft of farming. Not exclusively, but in different periods in Roman history, as the Roman Empire expanded, it became more so that way. And large farms became more of a feature on the Roman landscapes. Very large farms. We would call them factory farms.
Yeah, and that's something you put on the table with Pliny the Elder.
Yeah, Pliny the Elder, right.
Yeah, yep. Tell us about him, Pliny the Elder.
Okay, good. So Pliny is writing in the first century AD. Pliny was a naturalist in the best sense of the word. He was interested in everything that had to do with nature, and consequently that had to do with biological life and earth and nature in general. He actually died in during the eruption of Vesuvius because he got too close to the action, because he wanted to see it. He wanted to study it. He wanted to observe it and take notes. So he's sort of an early martyr for science. But his passage that you're referring to in the context of these large factory farms that sprung up it was a long process over hundreds of years that led to ultimately these large farms, but they're called latifundia, these just like expanse, that literally just means expansive farm. And from his vantage point in the early empire, he's and writing, just after the reign of the Emperor Nero, he saw this as a bad development, because it was a departure from, the good old days, quote unquote, of Republican Rome, where farms were run by the people who owned them, for one thing, and worked by the people who owned them, and that those people were citizens, first and foremost. They were citizens, soldier, farmers. So he decries the rise of latifundia, these large factory farms that were run by slave, you know, chain gangs of slaves. And he has a beautifully evocative passage where he says, like, Mother Earth, no wonder these days, he says, these days being, you know, 70 CE, these days it's no wonder we don't get the same sort of produce and profit from a farm, because the people who work it are doing so against their will. So why would Mother Nature want to cooperate there? She actually takes affront at that kind of abuse of the riches that she supplies. So it's a romanticized notion, but it's also an ideology, I think, that many in the new foods movement and small farming movement today would also subscribe to.
It sounds exactly the same.
Mm.
So what Pliny the Elder was complaining about way back then, so many of us are now complaining about today. Those big factory farms, those confined animal feeding operations, are so terrible. But back then, of course, they used slaves, and today the slaves are essentially chemicals and money. But the same thing is that we look at these giant farms and complain that they're not producing what we would like to eat, but yet we're not willing to go out and grow what we want to eat. So there we are. Let's go back to Vero and the animals, because that's another thing that we've been complaining about a lot these days, is the relationship with animals. And there are many who suggest that we should not have that relationship with animals, that we should stick with having that relationship with just plants. So what did Vero point out about our relationship with animals?
Well, Vero just, as an antiquarian, he just can't help himself to, delve into the past and look for interesting tidbits and details that he finds surprising, amazing, intriguing. And what he says in the passage that I include in the book is that, people have been living with animals for a very long time. It's a historical fact. It's a, paleo-archaeological fact. So we have been interacting with animals. We domesticated wild animals, but they also domesticated us. So he makes arguments like, you see animal language everywhere, even in our social structures of ancient Rome, Pharaoh says. So anyone who is trying to say that animals aren't intrinsic to our own way of living in the world, our own means of subsistence and farming, have got it wrong. So, the Latin word for money, pecunia, comes from the Latin word pecus, which means livestock, because lo and behold, once upon a time, it was, wealth was valued in terms of livestock. You've got myths, Pharaoh says, about the golden fleece and these massive heroic quests like Jason and the Argonauts traveling to Colchis to obtain the golden fleece, which is essentially, wool, special wool on a ram. So he's pointing out that humans have seen their interdependence with animals as intrinsic to their own historical and cultural development for a long time. And I think it's still true. We domesticated animals, but they also domesticated us. They do have a place on the farm and within a farming ecosystem. The question is, how many and how to raise them. And so they're more questions of particulars, I think, in solving contemporary problems rather than whether or not they belong, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, then we go back to sounding like Pliny the Elder complaining about factory farms, right?
Mm-hmm.
There. Well, you bring up several good snippets about Horus, one of which was the reverie of a would-be farmer. The other was simple tastes, and the third is avoiding the rat race. Who was Horace?
So Horace was a poet and a philosopher. We think he was kind of an Epicurean in his own leanings. So he had a view of life that was, you know, that we should live an untroubled life, avoiding, you know, the problems of urban living, and friendship was important to him, you know, pleasure, but in moderation, because excessive pleasure does no one any good. This is all kind of the Epicurean package that, you know, appears throughout his works, all of his poems. So he's a reflective poet, but he's a poet primarily. So the three passages that I include, well, actually, one other thing about Horace is that he was given a farm in the Sabine Hills by his patron and friend, Maecenas.
But before that, he kind of went bankrupt as a soldier, as I understand it.
Not so much Horace himself, perhaps, but I'm not sure if you, yeah. I wouldn't vouch necessarily for that particular detail, but okay. But the point is that he, all Roman poets relied for their livelihoods on the patronage of, you know, more substantial, influential politicians. So you have a dynamic in Roman poetry where, you know, you're trying to please and keep your patron interested in what you're saying in your poetry, but also to, you know, talk about the real issues of modern life through this lens of sort of mythological language and old stories that have been reused with new meaning. So in one of the Horace passages that you mentioned, you know, I think it's the getting out of the rat race, I forgot what I actually called it, is a very famous fable that Horace includes in one of his poems about the town mouse and the country mouse. And it's the story is perfect because it's a story, as Horace presents it, told by guests at his villa who are being wined and dined one evening in the Sabine Hills, relaxing, enjoying an evening. And it's a sort of after dinner party time where people tell stories to one another and it's all convivial. And one of the attendees tells the story of the town mouse and the country mouse, which serves as a parable also for Horace's own choices in life. And that is, you know, the city mouse goes to visit his friend in the country, is fed this humble fare and rough living and totally unpleasant as far as the urban mouse is concerned. And then the country mouse goes to visit the town mouse, and the town mouse thinks he's throwing, you know, this wonderful feast and treating him lavishly and thinks he's going to be all impressed. But, you know, the country mouse basically says, I'd rather be back on the farm, and packs up and scuttles out. So, yeah, Horace, his poetry is full of this sort of tension between country living and urban living. And he lived both worlds, and he just states his preference being, if I could, if I had my druthers, I'd be on my Sabine villa.
And I guess a lot of us would when it gets right down to it. And that's why you're on a farm, right?
Well, to be honest, I have to say I was pretty susceptible and impressionable to what I was reading when I was younger and I was studying the classics as a undergraduate and then a graduate student. And yes, I took it to heart. And, you know, we made choices to pursue that kind of life. I mean, we always kind of called it Plan B, but in fact, it was really Plan A, and the academic thing was Plan B. I'm glad they both worked out. So we actually, you know, built our own house and outbuildings, and we, you know, put up all our own fences, and we started from scratch with no real background in farming, only the idea. So it was a pay-as-you-go basis and a learn-as-you-go basis, and we're grateful. 20 years later, you know, we have a farm with 100 sheep, 5-6 cows, 2 donkeys, chickens, you know, the usual. We've had pigs in the past before. So we've learned a lot by living close to the land and living with animals and trying to follow that Hesiodic advice you mentioned at the very beginning of the show of, you know, thinking for yourself and being self-sufficient, but also listening to the good advice of others. You'd be a fool not to. So it's been this constant trial and error learning process of getting good input and just working hard.
But it seems to me your greatest crop has been your children.
You mean my actual children or all my students?
Well, both, but I was thinking of your actual children because you raised them on a farm and you homeschooled them.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Oh, okay. I didn't know that you knew that, but yeah, so I can tell you that kind of story in a very in short space. And it's sort of like you may have heard the story. We were just talking about the town mouse and the country mouse before. You've heard the story of the if you give a mouse a cookie sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how we got into farming and doing what we do. So my wife and I got married young, as things go today. I was 20. She was 17. It wasn't a shotgun wedding. It was all planned and by choice. We 3 years later, we had our first child, a boy. And we decided, well, you know, if we're going to take on the decision and the responsibility of actually having a child, we should probably like birth that child ourselves too. So we had home births for all three of our boys subsequent to that. And then we asked ourselves and like the same sort of logic or maybe illogic, if we're going to have them and if we're going to birth them ourselves, we had a midwife that came to the house and helped us, of course. We should be responsible primarily for educating them. Why would we want to like surrender them to somebody else or to a herd of, you know, herd thinkers? So that's what led to the homeschooling.
And with that, we just ran out of time. But I would like to point out that all three of your sons have grown up to be self-sufficient, independent thinkers, just like their parents. Thank you so much for joining us. M.D. Usher, Professor of Classical Languages and Literature, the University of Vermont, a farmer, and the author of this incredible book, How to Be a Farmer. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.